Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 228. How do you build a sustainable open source project and community? What lessons can be learned from Python's history and the current mess that the WordPress community is going through? This week on the show, we speak with Paul Everett from JetBrains about navigating open source funding and the start of the Python Software Foundation. Paul's been an organizer in the Python community almost from the beginning. He shares how the project has navigated through multiple sponsors. We talk about the early governance models and the formation of the Python Software Foundation. We contrast this journey with the current drama unfolding in the WordPress community. We discuss the potential problems of having a benevolent dictator for life. We also dig into sponsorship models and ways to get companies to give back to the open source projects that they rely on. This episode is sponsored by Sentry. At Sentry, we don't just build tools. We use them to debug our trickiest slowdowns. Hear the whole story later in the episode and find others like it at blog.sentry.io. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's funny, I was talking with Jody this morning, and she's like, oh, you get to be with him today. So she says hello to you.
Yeah, it's been a while. I think she was on in February, so it's been quite a while since we've talked, and hopefully be coming on soon here at the end of the year, and always excited to talk to her. So
you two are actually connected for me. It was, I think, the first PyCon after the pandemic, and she had just been with us for like 7 minutes.
Oh, really?
Just 2 weeks or something.
Yeah.
And she sat down with you and the two of you just hit it off and charted all kinds of cool things. It was great.
Yeah. You and Dan left the table. That was so funny. That was great. Yeah. PyCon 2022. And she's been on the show a whole bunch and it's always fun having her on the show. So thanks for connecting us there. The JetBrains connection.
My pleasure.
So one thing I thought about starting with, and I mentioned to you this before we got going, is instead of doing lots of backgrounds on like how people got into programming, mm-hmm. I've been very interested in how people got involved in open source and contributing to projects and stuff like that. Because I feel like it's a different angle. And it's also something that I feel like a lot of beginners and intermediate people are wondering what their next step is to maybe get into that and what are potential on-ramps. So maybe you could talk about your story briefly about how you got involved in open source.
Sure. It's super fun. And actually, I'll skip to the end and say, that's why you do it, because it's super fun.
Right.
It was, 1992. And I had just gotten kind of booted from Navy flight school. I had to find something else to do. And I was working for a guy whose job was the Navy internet manager.
Okay.
And I was helping find kind of services to put on the 56K backbone that we had.
I'm thinking early net internet here.
Yeah, baby. And one day, the guy who ran the domain for Navy.mil sat beside me. And I wheeled my chair back and I said, hey, can I have www.navy.mil? And he said, what's that? And so it wound up being like one of the first 200 websites. Back then, no kidding, you emailed Tim Berners-Lee and said, can you put me on the list? Guido has a similar story about Python. And I needed a scripting language. I wasn't going to do C. Wasn't going to do Bash. I've got this vivid memory of going to the bookstore. And for most of your listeners, books are these things that exist. You go to a store, you can look at them.
Right, right.
And there was a book on Perl. And I've got this super vivid memory of like picking the book and flip, flip, flip. Oh, hell no. Put it right back up. And at that time, you could download a PostScript file for the Python tutorial and just immediately fell in love, felt like it fit my brain. A couple of years later, out of the Navy, and there's a meetup, November 1994, first meetup that Guido did.
Okay.
And so went to that, got to meet everybody. Now, back to the how I got into open source. They're all smart. I'm not. So I kind of got involved on organizing.
Oh, cool.
And this is something that all of us in Python talk about, is there's lots of ways to be valuable to the open source movement.
Yeah.
And one of the big ones, we all talk about documentation, but another big one is organizing, helping with conferences, running meetups, being the kind of person that glues people together is a great and needed skill in a population full of some people who don't have all of those skills.
Yeah. Outreach may not be their strength.
Indeed. Yeah. And frankly, what they're good at is like the golden goose. So let's just support them doing the really important stuff. And so that was kind of my entree, was a non-traditional path into open source. And it really was fun in that first third of Python years. Learned a lot. And as Python really took off, getting back to your question, I learned a lot that this orchestra has a lot of different instruments in it.
Yeah.
And we need lots of different kinds of people, lots of different kinds of personalities in different geographic areas around the world.
I feel like I'm one of these people that is in between all those things. Like, I definitely like, obviously, have a podcast. I like talking to people. I like learning, you know, their stories and conveying them to other people. But I feel like I'm that person that can translate for a lot of people. And I feel like that's a really unique thing that,
well
that
said.
Is good.
I would say that about you, that you're kind of like a storyteller for all of us. And we need to keep our shared history, shared culture stitched together during the days of meteoric growth.
Yeah.
So that we pop out the other side still feeling good about who we are.
Yeah, yeah. So I wanted to have you come on and you kind of proposed this somewhat current events sort of topic that's happening in the world. And there's a lot of turmoil, if you will, in the open source community. Mm-hmm. Probably the largest bonfire is what's happening with WordPress right now. And I don't know if you want to explain it or I could try to do a short synopsis of it. Yeah, because it's definitely a drama and this is going to come out a little late. So I don't know what will have happened, you know, in the time between us talking about it. And
you're
going
to link to a page that has.
Yeah. Wampa. Yeah. And that's why I'm not going to go too deep in it. But the problem is it's confusing and probably my definitions are not going to be perfect. So I'm sorry. You don't necessarily need to send emails to me directly about clarifying these things because it's all PHP anyway, right? So, or I guess there may be a fork, which is an interesting one wrinkle I just heard of them going to make it be JavaScript too. Anyway, so part of the WordPress drama is there's WordPress.org, which is sort of the WordPress foundation that is supporting the continued development of WordPress as a platform. They are the open source maintainer of lots of things. I haven't done the deep research, but I'll include a link where it kind of gets into this. I got probably three different Verge articles that kind of go a little bit further. They're a good resource. I feel like they do their research. Matt Mullenweg is the co-founder of the organization there. And that's where it gets kind of interesting because he has a for-profit business that's called WordPress.com, which is a hosting business for WordPress sites. And the name of that company that is sort of the umbrella for that is called Automattic. It's spelled with an extra T, Matt, in the Matt Mullenweg part name there, which I just learned. So anyway, you have those two entities, and I'd kind of known about them for a long time. Along comes another organization that's, I'm not sure how long they've been around. That's another research thing I haven't done, but they're called WP Engine. They don't explicitly say what the WP stands for, but
everybody
it is a
knows,
WordPress hosting. Exactly. It is a WordPress hosting site, and they have investors. Silverlight, I think, is one of the sort of VC sort of investors type of thing. And Matt was going to go to this conference and then wrote this blog post and basically got very, very mad at WP Engine that they were not giving back to the WordPress community. He himself champions. Our company, Automatic, devotes 4,000 hours a week toward the open source project that is WordPress. And these guys are coming along and they're just sort of, you know, riding on the coattails and so forth. So the next step is not just being angry about it, but him starting to make maneuvers that are literally cutting off them being able to access parts of WordPress.org, which is where all the plugins are and things like that, and having ultimatums that are saying things like, you have to checkmark this box that says you are not involved with WP Engine in any way to be able to access the site.
Just log in, yeah.
Which is crazy.
And even internally, right? For his own employees.
Yeah, if you're an outside person, but you're just an open source person, you've been contributing plugins and so forth. Mm-hmm. And on the side, maybe you do jobs. We all do that, you know, as developers, and something's involved with WP Engine. Like, why should that person get in between there? Like, how does that get into the whole thing? So it's a very, very messy situation. And the fire is still raging in a lot of ways. In fact, there's multiple lawsuits from both sides on mm-hmm. the thing. I don't know how it'll shake out, but there have been other sort of flames in the open source community mm-hmm. over the last several years. And I can kind of feel like a general frustration from some maintainers that, hey, open source takes more than just, you know, free energy from all these developers. It requires maintenance and bug reports and so forth. And large corporate entities are going to just take that.
Freeloaders, yeah.
And use it. It feels like there's not this push and pull. And I've talked about this a handful of times on the show, and I feel it's really important. I've had conversations with somebody from Tidelift and the Open Source Initiative, and I've talked to individual developers like Russell Keith McGee. We talked about it very early on about Beware and him just saying, I can only do this part-time and I want to do more with it. And then him in a later interview talking about how, hey, he's now got funding to be able to work full time on this, and how he has, you know, support from Anaconda, which is really cool. And I know that we've championed the PSF getting funding from a variety of different mm-hmm. organizations. So it's an interesting time. And so I feel like you have this really interesting background when you sent me this email, like saying, hey, I've been involved in organizing things like the Python Software Foundation, which I didn't know, which that'll be fascinating to talk about, the Plone Foundation. So I'm intrigued to like learn like, okay, well, how do you organize those things? But more importantly, how do we structure them and protect them in a way that they can be sustained? And then maybe who knows how far this conversation can go.
Sure.
It's one of these things where we typically want to keep it an hour, but I know we could talk for a long time about it. And you guys at JetBrains are also have some things you probably want to talk about too, that you are doing your job of giving back to the community. So mm-hmm. what did I miss in there? Did I hit most of the points?
I think you did hit, especially the summary of what's going on in WordPress really does get to the nub of the thing, so to speak.
Yeah.
And then a lot of things flow out of that, but it helps us focus, keep the main thing the main thing.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to mention is just how big WordPress is. I think a lot of Python people may not know if they never looked at it.
Oh, yeah.
But it's 43% of all websites use WordPress. Yeah,
you're right.
It's huge.
It's like everyone talking about this JavaScript framework, that JavaScript framework, and jQuery is sitting over there saying,
hello.
No, I've got like 5 more zeros on my downloads than you do. So,
right.
You keep being cute over there in the corner. For this thing going on with WordPress, one thing that I'd like to perhaps be a little contrarian on is kind of quick judgment and who's the heroes and who's the villains.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that who we all think is the villain is the villain.
Okay.
But maybe there is kind of a deeper point about open source and money. And who feeds the cow and who milks the cow.
Sure.
And how to do that fairly. And I take that analogy about the cow all the way back to my experiences in 1998 when we took venture capital funding and learned some lessons about all of this.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that it has come up in the last few years and stuff. And you see these things Amazon would do, like take multiple data storage projects. And just kind of like semi-fork them, not obey the copyright because they're not actually distributing a fork. They're just found a loophole with the hosting thing. And then people have to do self-defense by coming up with a new license to prevent that. And there's all this stuff that doesn't really help the actual code. And this is where I say the main thing. All of us in Python need to realize that there's more involved than, oh, it's under an open source license, we're safe. No.
Yeah.
There's a lot more that goes into the whole product, not just the product. Things like trademarks and contributor license agreements and patents and assignments and all these other kinds of things. And that really gets into my point about who's the villain, who's the hero, is that maybe there was this kind of really legitimate first cry of outrage of y'all are milking the cow and you're not feeding the cow.
Right.
Now, the fact that the guy crying out about this has a few hundred million in the bank, not feeling it. But there is a point that helps us lead into a discussion about Python.
Yeah. This week's sponsor is Sentry. At Sentry, we hit a 2-second slowdown in our API response times. Here's how we dug deep and fixed it fast. While monitoring Sentry's backend, we noticed our P99 response time, meaning the slowest 1% of requests, had spiked to over 2 seconds. Starting from our trace view, we discovered our rate limit middleware was the culprit. With our profiling tools, we were able to trace the issue to a classic cold start problem. Luckily, the fix was relatively straightforward. We adjusted our configuration to warm up our servers ahead of time, and our P99 latency dropped to 176 milliseconds, a win in our book. At Sentry, we don't just build tools, we use them to debug our trickiest slowdowns. Read the whole story and others like it at blog.sentry.io.
Well, I'm intrigued. I know you want to tell the story of Zope because we discussed it a long time ago that we might come on and talk about it. So I think we'd have to leave it a little abbreviated here. But I'm intrigued by it because it's a name that I see in the background of some other projects, but I don't necessarily know that much about it or the history there. And I think it might help us in the idea of like, how did you structure it and so forth. And
my goodness, the number of hours. I love talking about this kind of stuff because I think it's important. It's part of our shared history. And these things, as WordPress shows, are there. It's a thing. Python is ours. And that's kind of a central point here. Python is ours. It's not quote unquote theirs, whoever you want to choose there to be. And we need to be good custodians of Python. Here's an interesting point. You know, in some of these discussions along the way, it's like, who owns Python 100 years from now?
Yeah, sure.
Free Software Foundation, specifically Bradley Kuhn at Software Freedom Conservancy and Eben Moglen, talking about conservatorship and thinking, you know, like multiple generations into the future. Well, it was all cute in the 1990s when the number of Python people could fit in a moderate sized Coliseum. But now, Python is there for humanity. I mean, it's a BFD.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we do have to be good custodians for it. So would you like me to go back and kind of talk about the genesis of some of these things about the organizing of Python?
Yeah, yeah. I know we wanted to hit on why the Python Software Foundation was created would be one of them, definitely. And it's basically the protection of this thing, you know, taking care of it. And
the funny story of that first November 94, which means that the first Python event happened 30 years ago next month, which is like really cool.
Wow. Yeah, yeah. Very cool.
Is that the thing I participated in was like starting to write bylaws for a freaking consortium of something that had like 20 people. There were like 20 people at this meetup. So that was like a total waste of time. It was such a me thing to do, to go waste everyone's time talking about something like that. But a couple of years later, it started to become a little more important. And Guido and the Python team, I'll say, was at CNRI, Corporation for National Research Initiatives. Guido has a lot of written history on this, so I won't belabor too much of the point. it's a pretty fascinating time.
Maybe we can share some links in the the notes here. Yeah.
What he and the others were doing and how they were getting funded and stuff like that. And then there became this time period where the conferences were being organized. Also at CNRI was the outfit called ForTech, which organized the World Wide Web conferences and tried to do professional grade conferences. I think they also might have organized the IETF meetings and some other big things. And they got involved to kind of professionalize the Python conferences.
Okay.
Not that they have an invalid point. We called them Spam 1, Spam 2, Spam 3. That was the naming convention for the conferences back in the day.
All right.
And so they got changed into, I think, IP, International Python Conference. And like the prices went up and stuff like that. That whole episode is actually a pretty interesting point for this discussion because during that time, we created something called the Python Software Activity, PSA, which was the predecessor to the PSF.
Okay.
But its real concept was consortium.
What do you mean by that?
The people that, businesses that depended on Python would come together.
Okay.
For what purpose? Really, at the end of the day, offsetting the cost of Python development.
Okay.
But also representing their interests so that it was safe to bet their business on Python.
Okay. If they were going to use this, we need to make sure it is continued to be developed.
Correct. It's continued to be developed, but these whole product, WHOLE product things, these things outside of the software that businesses depend on, you know, can I get a legal agreement? Am I going to get sued for using this software?
Okay.
Do you actually, Python? Huh, that word sounds familiar. Can I use it? Do I have to TM it? What's going on here?
Okay.
And that origin story kind of, even though the stakes were exceptionally small at the time, we were thinking about those kinds of things because those kinds of things are important. They're hard to put back in the bottle later.
Right, right.
As Mozilla found out with their triple license scheme, like half a decade after that. So the PSA didn't work for a similar... I also have to give a caveat. I'm giving my version of the story.
Sure.
And my version of the story, it's true-ish, but it's also entertaining. I just want to caveat it that, you know, others involved, particularly Guido, will have a more definitive story because they saw it much more closely. But the development of Python for CNRI and this PSA that was happening and then the growth of Python all kind of culminated with the Python 1.6 2.0 double release, which is this interesting moment in history where they both kind of came out at the same time, timed with Guido's exit from CNRI and going to... with the Python lab team to a California startup called BeOpen.
Okay.
And CNRI wanted their name in the book.
Hmm.
And so when you fire up the interpreter and do credits, you'll see CNRI's name.
Okay.
Because they were paying for the Python team and felt that they had intellectual property rights over the work product.
Hmm. Okay.
And then BeOpen asked for the same thing. About 9 months after the BeOpen thing, we had our company. We had gotten our last round of $12.5 million, and Guido and team came to work for us. And when during the employment contract talks, we put into the employment contract, our name is never going to appear in anything that you can find from the interpreter prompt.
Okay.
That the work product of Python was. Even if we paid, even if they did it on the clock, it's theirs.
Hmm.
I bring this up because a similar thing was happening at the same time. The experience from the Python Software Activity and the International Python Conference, kind of corporatizing prematurely the conference, got out of the way. And the first thing that happened was the Python Software Foundation, the kind of comptroller for my company, was the original treasurer and kind of sprung it into existence. But Greg Stein and I were the two bootstrap officers, board members.
Okay.
You got to have something that creates the something.
in order to have a foundation, you need
the thing that makes the foundation factory.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
So the PSF sprung into existence, and it was a shoe that fit the right foot, because it was about owning the work product of Python.
Okay.
Collectively.
Right.
For humanity. The work product of Python, the trademarks.
Right.
Hard problem. International jurisdiction of trademarks. That is complex. Your only hope is to pay an agency who has the legal experience in all these jurisdictions.
Isn't that something that has reared its ugly head in the EU recently, right? With sort of regulation of software and security and things like that, where it's like, well, who owns this thing? Yeah. Who's responsible for it? Yeah. It's been interesting. Yeah, because the mission statement, I don't know if it remained the same or has been modified, but the Python Software Foundation mission statement is, the mission of the Python Software Foundation is to promote, protect, and advance the Python programming language and to support and facilitate the growth of a diverse and international community of Python programmers.
Well said.
Was that the original? Or is that
I don't know modified? If it was the original. Doubt it. Because that sounds pretty good.
Yeah, definitely.
And just to say that by the time that happened, and really at that point, all the eggs are in the community's basket as represented by Guido, the group that got PyCon back on track are equal heroes in this whole story.
Okay.
Defending trademarks takes money. Where's the money going to come from? Well, if you have a volunteer-run conference, it can make some money, and it can go solve problems of the commons. And maybe it's the pairing of those two that really are the secret to Python's success beyond the engineering of Python, is that Python went into the commons.
Okay.
And the commons was able to administer it. Back in those days, I gave talks on open source business models. I actually, I gave a talk titled Funding the Perfect Beast, because that Don Henley song was popular at the time.
Okay.
At a venture capital conference. They put me up in the Ritz-Carlton in San Francisco. Never been. That's the nicest hotel room I've ever been in.
Sure. So this is late 90s?
This would be like 99.
Yeah, okay.
From a kind of business model perspective, one of the things that I talked about, if I can make a little bit of tangent and get back over the WordPress thing.
Yeah.
Our company was called Digital Creations. Our open source software is called Zope.
Okay.
I had this slide. Oh my God, this is so embarrassing. I had this slide called The Perfect Distance. And I said that the project and the company need to be a perfect distance apart.
Okay.
It's too far away, no one will believe it's sustainable. But if it's too close, people will think they're volunteer shills working for a VC.
The helicopter parent of...
Perhaps.
something, yeah. Okay.
And then when we got our third round and they installed a grown-up CEO, the first thing he did was change the name of the company to match the name of the product.
Ouch.
And really, that gets into what's going on here with the WordPress thing, is that there are these assets that are valuable that aren't the software.
Yeah.
Who gets that? Where is that value captured? Who gets to capture that value? Is it proportional to the people who put in the value? Should we ask questions like that? Or is it open source and people can do what they want? What do you think?
Being late to programming and being late to open source, meaning over the last 5 years and a little bit longer, it just fascinates me to no end the amount of effort that people have volunteered into existence.
Yeah.
I always wondered in the back of my mind, at what point does that graciousness and and willing to do this, like, where does it eventually like hurdle or fall apart or whatever? And so I've been very, very intrigued by reaching out and getting corporate sponsorship for things like developer in residence and all these other kinds of interesting things that have been happening there. And so I don't know if I'm answering the question, but I'm really intrigued by a lot of what's happening. And I like the structure of the Python Software Foundation, how it's not a company, you know, in a way, and it's kind of protecting this thing that I am very intrigued by and want to, you know, protect. And I like that other things like the Django Foundation and so forth, try to model that in a similar way. There's some huge projects. I just had an episode where I talked about all the different things that are using Django today based upon a recent article that you guys had about Django project ideas at JetBrains there. And it's just fascinating to me, like that balancing act. And I worry, I guess, about a lot of this stuff of people ripping up stakes and saying, you can't use this thing anymore, or potentially doing something malicious that is used way down in the dependency tree. You know, all these things that we've seen, and us, you know, people at the end of the thing that as a teacher, wanting people to be informed about these things and be cautious about these things and being aware of it. And I haven't done a story about UV yet. And that's another one where I feel there's some nervousness there because it is a company. And well, what does that mean? What is the longevity there? What is, you know, are they going to be, I believe they're venture backed, but I don't know that for sure. They are. Okay. So, you know, when do they get upset and want to change things and want to put their features in because, you know, they feel things, and it, you know, when does it become quid pro quo and stuff like that? So those are my ideas on it. I guess I'm just muddying the waters a little bit, but those are my concerns and hence why I want to talk about this stuff.
Sure. I'll pick one of the things you said first and tug on that thread a little bit, because I think it becomes the answer to what you said second.
Okay.
The word think is doing some heavy lifting because it's kind of like pull out of my butt, but here you go.
Sure.
Companies like JetBrains give back to open source. Give back to open source in a variety of ways. It's really cool what's being done. They could just be a vendor that looks at Python the way a coal miner looks at a mountain. But we've got some companies in the Python ecosystem, like JetBrains, that kind of realize we're in it together.
Right.
And the only reason we're making money is because that thing's popular.
True.
Less that thing's unpopular, bad news for us.
Who's going to need a tool to use it?
That's right.
Yeah.
The demand for COBOL IDEs, it's not peaking. Yeah,
it's a little low.
And so these various ways that JetBrains gives back are kind of interesting to me. And then you also mentioned like Visionary Sponsor, which was the very first, I believe it was Google.
Yeah.
And they had a problem they wanted solved, but they wanted it solved collectively, because if they solved it themselves, they weren't actually solving the problem. You got to solve it upstream.
Yeah.
And so these efforts to solve collective problems with money from entities that have a financial interest becomes the winning formula.
Seems like it.
Only if you've got a viable PSF.
Okay.
In particular, if you've got an executive director that's hustling, chasing down money, closing the deal,
yeah,
getting the signature on the check, and then following through to keep that sponsor happy.
Yeah. I feel like that's such a key thing that I always hear kind of on the side, like, what do we do? Well, we protect the trademark of of Python. And it's like, I see how that could get muddy when you start accepting outside funds. So,
well said. Yeah. That very, very good point is that even if these mega courts give money out of benevolence, where's the hidden agenda?
Yeah.
So going through the PSF kind of money launders it a little bit, because people trust the PSF because I have agency in that by voting in, and we know them and we know what they're about.
Right. Even the shifts of the last several years of the PSF to have a steering council and things like that have moved away from what was a pretty common thing for big software projects of this benevolent dictator, which I don't know where Matt fits on that spectrum right now, where the benevolence is. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's kind of an interesting thing where you kind of wonder like, okay, well, you know, when does that person become a tyrant, or when do they get upset in some way and so forth? And
which is the natural course of huge open source projects, I think.
Okay. Yeah. See, I don't have that arc of history as well to be able to see like, oh, but I've heard other communities falling in that way. Yeah. Like maybe is it Ruby that had a similar thing over the last several years, but yeah, it's kind of wild. And hopefully we can keep our own internal fires limited.
Sure, sure.
We've definitely had stories that bubble up here and there, but it seems like there's at least ways that we're, you know, have release valves and other things to kind of keep it going. Yeah. So
a governance model doesn't have to be perfect, but when it gets it wrong, it needs to be able to correct. And that's a better measure of a governance model.
Yeah.
But I think really it just kind of we should all pause for a moment. I used to say this about Plone back in the day, that Plone is democracy. It's the software, valuable. But like the Plone Foundation as the instrument of the software is an equal achievement. The PSF, equal achievement. The Django Software Foundation, equal achievement.
Yeah. This week, I want to shine a spotlight on another RealPython video course. It uses a real-world project to help you hone your skills with wrangling data using Python. It's titled, Using Pandas to Make a Gradebook in Python. The course is based on a step-by-step RealPython tutorial by Brian Weber. And in the course, instructor Cesar Aguilar takes you through how to load and merge data from multiple sources with pandas, how to filter and group data within a pandas data frame, and then calculating and plotting the grades from that data frame. Along the way, you'll practice many of the skills you need to work effectively with pandas, like working with CSV files, aggregating values, and how to assemble it all into a real-world project. And like all the video courses on RealPython, the course is broken into easily consumable sections. Plus, you get additional resources and code examples for the techniques shown. All of our course lessons have a transcript, including closed captions. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the enhanced search tool on realpython.com. I feel, you know, I don't have as much familiarity with Plone. I don't know if you want to just briefly just, you know, describe the project. Mm-hmm. I know you're very involved with it, and I feel like it's jumping off of your history with Zope a little bit. Again, we might have to have a separate episode that dives deeper into these things, but what is Plone?
Right. I will limit it to just the scope of this conversation. It's a community-run open source content management system.
Okay, CMS.
I haven't been involved in at least a decade. They just had a really neat profile of global footprint of small businesses and independent consultants. And from the very beginning, the founders acted collectively.
Okay.
And then the founders departed the scene and it kept on cooking. And so it organized into a foundation with help from Evan Moglen. The kind of lesson applies to these others as well, like the PSF. But I also want to talk a little bit about the founder part that you said. I remember back, I'll just say 2007, maybe-ish, when Guido was at Google and App Engine.
Okay.
And even then, he was starting to delegate and kind of get out of the D part in BDFL.
Sure, sure.
Dictator. And I said to him at that early time that this is actually a heck of an achievement that Python can continue without you because of what you're consciously making it possible for Python to go on. Now, through turbulent circumstances, that became, and the walrus operator, that became a little more urgent a number of years later. And if, for those that remember, when Guido said, I'm out, he also said, and I'm not choosing what's next. You figure it out. What do you think of that? Was that like a brilliant move?
I literally got into Python right as this was happening. It was very interesting to me. It was my first Python job. And so I would be listening to like Talk Python and they're like, oh, this is happening and this is happening. And so I was very intrigued by it at the time. And I did one of my first courses was on Python, I guess 3.8. And one of the announcements was that we now have a steering council. And so I got to talk a little bit about that in the course. And so I did a little research about like, oh, they needed this new model and they kind of built it up. And to me, a lot of the planning that went into it, a lot of thought went into it. Like we're going to, you know, limit the amount of time that people can be on this thing. I think that can be good. Mm-hmm. I like the idea of councils. There have been modern political nonsense going ourselves. I don't think lifetime things are good. Yeah, I think there should be limits, personally. I think it's important to change out things. There can be, you know, waves and directions one way or the other that things sway, but I feel like in general it can course correct, especially if they're paying attention to the community and you know what this project's for. So I think it's a good idea. And I think it was a good move.
What you just described is more art than science.
Yeah, absolutely. You
know, something that can bend without breaking.
Yeah, true.
I'm listening to this really long podcast series on the French Revolution. And let's just say they struggled to settle on a governance model.
Yeah, certain things were sharpened along the way.
Certain things were sharpened, yeah. Yep. They had a different code of conduct mechanism.
Yeah, totally.
So bringing this back to the PSF and yeah. that kind of the execution model, huh, that's great.
Nice.
The PSF is a viable instrument of collective will. It's staffed. It has money. It can set goals. It can achieve things. Here's one I want you. Can I assign work to you?
Okay.
Can I make you do something? Can you do like the oral history of like Pie Ladies and Django Girls? And when Jessica McKellar decided to make PyCon the instrument of gender diversity in Python. And in the course of like 3 years, it went from 3% of the speakers were women to like 30%. And it just feels like it wasn't accidental. It was intentional.
Right. It was focused, intentional work.
Yeah. And yeah. it needed someone who was going to make it happen no matter the odds and money.
Yeah. I had a recent talk with Jay Miller, you know, about Black Python devs. And
great.
And the reaction very often from developers is like, well, why do we need to have teams? And why do we need to have sides and stuff like that? And I'm like, I am interested in growing the diversity of things. Mm-hmm. I've tried to do that on my show. It's a hard thing. I think an oral history would be fascinating. I don't know if I could do like a side series about it, but I would be interested in talking to those people.
Yeah.
I also talked to one of the organizers of PyCon Africa, actually two over a couple of times, talked to Marlene, and then I had somebody on recently to talk about it. And that's fascinating.
It is.
You know, again, them struggling to just get it going again, you know?
They give me hope.
Yeah. I like talking to organizers. I don't know if it's a popular topic for my listeners. Mm-hmm. I wonder that sometimes. Like, I wonder how much of that is there. I'm definitely, you know,
yeah, sure.
You as an organizer, I find it fascinating to talk to people who want to bring people together and organize that way. So yeah, but it's, I think it's an important part of any organization to see that. And when people say, I feel welcome going to a PyCon, I feel like I can belong here, or just from the outside, I said this when I started, I was learning several languages. I had learned SQL, I mm-hmm. was learning JavaScript, and I was learning stuff. And the only like community that I would see, and this was through podcasts, through organizations, through other things, I immediately noticed like, this seems like a friendly language. I don't know if I can put my finger on it, you know, but like, I feel like the people that talk about it are excited about it and interested in it. And I'd go and I'd look at JavaScript stuff and it was just like, I don't know. It was like this low level of upsettedness. Lord of the Flies. And they were just not, they were like, you're wrong. He's wrong. Everybody's wrong. And I'm just like, what is this? Like, I don't even know who to trust. And I don't feel like I want to be engaged in this community. And maybe it's changed. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I haven't been focused on it because I was like, I like this thing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I've focused on it since then. So, but it's interesting how a programming language can have a culture, but it can, and it, mm-hmm. it takes work, which is kind of hidden. So
you mentioned about Jay and Black Python devs and Python Africa, and at the Django conference, I got to hang out with all of them. And I got to say, it gave me the same kind of feeling I had at that meetup in 1994. Like, this is a cool place, and I think something cool is going to happen here. And
yeah,
those people are the right people. They are just so energizing. It puts gas in your tank to hang out with Velda and Monica and Jay and all of them.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're right about telling the stories. We need to know who we are. We need to know why we are. And providing a place, Brett Cannon, very famously,
yeah,
says, come for the language, stay for the community. Brett really is probably my hero of Python. I admire that guy.
I love talking to him. Totally. He's so fun to talk to. Yeah.
He's famous for saying that. But we had, 6-7 PyCons ago. Guido didn't want to do the keynote, so we did a panel discussion, Python 1994, about that first meetup. We had Guido and Barry and Jim Fulton from Zope and Robin Friedrich, who were all there at that meetup. And Jim said something that I think really galvanized it. There was a question about Python had this reputation then as the friendly place to go. You went to Perl and hung out with the Perl people, and then like, oh, I need to take a shower. This is gross. And then you come over to Python, and everyone's like super happy to have you and all that stuff. And Jim made the point that Python is warm and human because Guido is warm and human.
A lot of that founder energy.
Sure. Yeah. And just sets the tone from the beginning. And then the next generation of heroes kind of adopt that tone. And then the next out, out, out. And it has seemed to work.
Again, I have little experience in communities of other programming languages, and but I'm intrigued by them. Just even sometimes just like watching the conversation around things, you know, the websites and other things that, and as they discuss stuff. And it's kind of amazing that it's held and with this insane growth.
No kidding.
The welcoming of all these other communities. Cause like you think about data science and you think about universities and all these different places that are using it and that sort of interest. And even though they've pulled Python in a lot of ways, trying to pull it in these other directions and have developed some of their own tools, the people that I've talked to that are more on that side of things still love the language and are still interested in contributing back some of their things. Sometimes those ideas don't always work, I think. But I appreciate that, you know, and so it's kind of wild just to watch, you know. And I like talking to, I mean, one of the things I've been interested in much more lately is just, you know, how are people using the language? And I've been trying to find more of those stories and more of those people and get them in, as guests on the show. And
I have a historical example to reinforce the point you're making about Python preserving its identity with this influx of data scientists who really are quite different than developers.
Yeah, yeah.
Somewhere around 1999, I'll say, maybe 2000, there was one of the International Python conferences.
Okay.
In Arlington, Virginia.
Okay.
Snowed like hell. Key Bridge Marriott. The most famous thing from that was, oh God, Randy Pausch, the last lecture guy, the guy got famous, dying of cancer and spends a year Carnegie Mellon going around giving lectures. He gave the keynote on Alice, a visualization project in Python.
Oh, neat.
Really famous, actually, apropos for this point. He had this slide with a big circle and a tiny circle. The big circle was 99%. And the little circle was 1%. And he's like, this little circle is y'all. This big circle is everybody else. And you think it's fine to have variable names with different cases to be significant? And the rest of them are like, I do not know what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
And but for the point was, we had a separate track for Zope.
Okay.
The Zope track. It was pretty big.
At that particular conference?
At that particular conference, okay. And for the two conferences after that. And it was pretty big and had a lot of new people in it. Actually, some of them went on to become famous in the world of Python. But kind of the precedent was set was, they're in another room. They're not us. They're not Python. They're Zope.
Okay.
We probably had it coming. But the data science people have, despite being even more different than the Zope people were, have matriculated in pretty nicely into the world of Python.
Yeah, yeah. The one example I had recently, I have to look up the episode, I'll include the show notes, but there was a recent tool for kind of quickly building web apps and so forth, and it was using their particular way of writing Python. Mm. And I had to specify multiple times, this is not going to look like PEP 8 to you. It's going to look really weird. And, you know, Christopher Trudeau always has much more background than me, which is fantastic for me all the time. He's like, yeah, they're functional people.
Okay.
they write things in a functional way. And so they're structuring stuff in this way. And even just like, you know, the casing of things and so forth. And it doesn't matter because it works in Python, but it's going to look weird. And I could feel like this thing, like, I like seeing it, but I don't know if I'm going to write it like that because it looks weird. It looks foreign, you know.
It's always been fascinating to me that the first argument to a method doesn't have to be called self.
Okay.
But everybody does it.
Oh, it could be whatever you'd like to call it. Yeah. It's just a standard. Yeah. One of the things that we talked about here is getting into this idea of how companies can contribute, what sort of those agreements look like, and the protection of your trademark and protection of your open source project. And we mentioned Google, but gosh, there's been a whole bunch, like Meta. They've been very involved helping with the GIL and so forth. And Microsoft literally is helping with the Faster Python project with Guido and Eric Brandt and all these different people. So it's been kind of fascinating. What are the kinds of things that you guys are doing at JetBrains? Because you said that you guys are interested in contributing.
Right. And this is a good point to bring up because it's kind of hard to compare to like these Fortune 100 megacorps who have just a lot of resources.
Right.
But medium-sized companies can be part of this as well because they're invested as well.
Yeah.
Like Sentry has some interesting things and interesting approaches to giving back to open source. And we at JetBrains have done a lot of things over the years. Most recently is OpenCV, probably the reason why you and I are talking, because we're just announcing a sponsorship relationship. I'm going to be on a webinar with them.
Okay.
Talking about what we do. And that's another example of a governance model that should be celebrated. But you know what's better than celebrating it? Supporting it.
Yeah,
because we're all in it together.
Yeah.
And so those that get, we've been talking for most of the time about those that get value should give value.
Yeah.
Is that complicated? Does that make sense to you?
I think it gets complicated in sort of the corporate hierarchy and who makes that decision and people understanding that, yes, it's free to use this thing, and the problem is it's never relayed to those
people
that have the purse strings.
That's indeed.
Yes, it is free that we can use this thing, but how does it sustain? How does it support? Sure. If we decide to do this thing, we should make sure it's there.
Because the second group says, so what you're saying is I could actually not cut this check.
Yeah.
And the check doesn't get cut.
Yeah.
I agree with you. That distinction between the believers and the payers, that's a big in these, that's like seven org chart levels in some companies.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think that happens so often now. I feel like that's happening a little bit with AI, like in a way it's kind of scaring me that the idea that we can just take all this stuff. And it's like, okay, well, you know, like what are you willing to destroy just to have this thing? And
extraction.
Yeah. And this sort of extraction. And I just feel like there's a lot of unsustainable greed in some of these things that is, you know, scary. I'm not saying as much of that as far as open source, but yeah, there is a need to understand that there needs to be a better definition of like, well, how do you as a person who works for a company, explain that to people? Like,
right.
What's a good short explainer?
So for me at JetBrains, you know, we're a big medium-sized company.
Okay.
That's a good way to put it. We have lots of IDEs, so we have lots of communities and stuff like that. But for the world of Python, it's kind of cool the different kinds of things we're doing. We're doing this OpenCV thing, really proud of that. We have for a number of years done the DSF campaign and the PSF campaign, where for a period of time, there's a fundraiser, you get PyCharm at a discount, and the money goes to the foundation.
Yeah.
And for the DSF, for a while, it was like a lot of their annual income.
I'm sure it would really help the Django Software Foundation.
It obviously helped us as well. Now we have these other places where we're just like not trying to get anything in return. We're just trying to be the good guys. An example that's close to my heart is Jay Miller gave the keynote at PyCon this year.
Yeah.
Black Python Devs had its 1 year birthday and we had a birthday party in the PyCharm booth.
Oh, that's cool.
Played music, got photos, all that kind of stuff. Launched some balloons. The balloons got us in trouble with the conference facility. We had to go up and get the balloons.
Yeah.
Lesson learned.
Yeah. It needs special equipment to get those out.
Now I know. It was just one balloon. It wasn't supposed to get away, but ultimately a balloon's going to get away. But that's the kind of thing where we gave a donation to Black Python Devs, tried to be like one of the first ones to give money so that Jay could then say, hey, they gave money. Why don't you give money?
Sure.
And
this is a thing that happens.
Indeed, it is a thing. Everybody, give money to Black Python Devs. So those are different kinds of things to do. Some of them are like really premeditated and take a big infrastructure and sign off. And other ones are just like, hey, you're valuable. Here's a little something.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder sometimes just like the stress of, you know, maintaining an open source project. I mean, I mentioned how some projects are getting some support.
Mm-hmm.
Tidelift is an interesting organization. I still don't completely understand everything that's happening there. And the open source initiative is another one that's, again, trying to connect people, you know, and also one of the things that the it goes back to this quid pro quo thing. And I know I've been saying that a lot, sorry, but I feel like a corporation says, oh, well, now we have a direct line to that project and we can get our stuff fixed and we can get our issues dealt with and so forth. And that can be part of that in kind of an interesting way. The direct assumption, though, it shouldn't be there. There should be definitely some kind of rules and guardrails and so forth around what that involves. Do you have any experience with that?
Sure.
Okay.
I'll skip to the end of the movie and say, you are exactly right.
Okay.
Back when we had Zope and we were a consulting company, the theory with massive scare quotes around it was, we will do things on consulting gigs that fund the advance of the platform.
Okay.
Pretty interesting formula. Everybody wins. The customer wins because the last thing they want is to be the owner of some intellectual property.
Okay.
That they have to maintain into oblivion they barely understand.
Right.
Funny enough, it was difficult to explain this to customers. They wanted to they wanted to own what they paid for.
But who owns software at all?
I tried to say, this isn't an asset, it's a liability.
Well, it's just so funny, like in the world of video games, which I'm into, this whole idea of, do you even own the game?
Oh, yeah.
If it is a online hosted thing, like when you've paid whatever amount. So it's kind of like, well, you need to just think of it more as an experience and how much time you invested in. I think it's a good value, you know, generally, but I know that, you know, other people are like, well, we need to preserve these things, you know, kind of going back to that conversation and like, you know, make sure that this stuff is maintained in a certain way. So, well, we hit on a lot of different things. Is there anything that you want to touch on? I don't know if there's like advice or things that we want to share here at the end to say, along with, hey, you should mention to your, if you work for a company, you know, that, hey, maybe you should figure out a way that you can, you know, donate money and keep these things going. Not only, you know, the Python Software Foundation, but maybe even other smaller projects that, that you're using the tools of and make them keep going. Cause I know that that's happening more and more, like the Palettes Project or other kinds of, you know, things that are organizing in a way. The Django Software Foundation, obviously, and Plone and so forth. Do you have other advice that you could say, hey, if you have the ear of the person with the purse strings, what you could say to them?
Sure. I'll give one particular story and then use my standard closeout to kind of reference the point you're making. One of my great friends and business partner, Chris McDonough, lives 5 kilometers that way.
Okay.
the creator of tons of software that people depend on, including the thing that sat inside Docker for many years as the orchestrator of Docker called Supervisor.
Wow.
Tons of other things. And never got the money he deserved. These other companies, Yelp, he's the author of Pyramid. Pyramid powered Yelp and Reddit and some other things. And the money never flowed back to him. And that was when I started to think this open source business model thing was kind of falling apart. Even as consulting, it was hard to get the value extractors to contribute back to the golden goose.
Yeah. I was going to say the word is truly extraction. It's just like.
So what I'll say with kind of my standard close and then make the point that you're making is in my Python 1994 talk, I talk about the first third of Python. And then the middle third of Python is when the PSF arrived, PyCon arrived, money started coming in, gender diversity happened in this big new population.
Yeah.
Really exciting growth. And then the third is kind of the arrival of data science. Now, the fallacy in this is that there's a third. So in my mathematical universe, there's a fourth third, there's a fifth third. It can continue on.
Exactly.
So in this fourth third, there's going to be a new generation of heroes. Let it be you, anyone that's listened to the end of this.
Yeah.
Let it be you. Get involved. And it's our job, the ones that were there before, to make you successful and for you to have a canvas to paint your own dreams on.
Right.
That said, Python's about to enter this phase where it won't be like 2 to 3, but it'll be sort of like that. No GIL, free threading, sub interpreters, JIT, maybe more type henning, these kinds of things. They're going to break a lot of packages.
Yeah. There's going to be need to be a lot of support behind those changes.
Indeed. And so if you've got money and you're shipping a Python package and you go to these people and yell at them and you don't have a check in your hand, I hope they give you the middle finger because you deserve it.
Right. Yeah. Why can't my corporation keep using this thing? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I like to ask everybody who comes on the show a couple questions.
Sure.
What's something that's got you excited about the world of Python right now?
I hate to be selfish, but
okay.
There's a PEP 750 for template strings.
Uh-huh.
And it's largely Jim Baker.
Okay.
Who was the maintainer of Jython for a long time, for a while at least. And Guido and me and Dave Peck and Lissandros and Kudai. And it just wrapped up its second round of review. It might
be 314.
Maybe a good chance of going in 314.
Okay.
And the premise for me is to bring the developer experience of JavaScript web development to Python. People who like tooling and want it in HTML and other kinds of languages will feel like they don't have to leave Python to get it.
Okay.
That will be an interesting thing if we can pull off and try and jettison Python, kind of teleport Python's web development story into this decade.
Yeah. The next one is, what's something that you want to learn next? This doesn't have to be about programming. Mm-hmm. It can be about anything that you feel like you want to learn next. Mm-hmm.
French.
Okay.
I have a particular, highly important reason for that.
Oh,
I'll leave that out. But I'll actually go back to programming.
Okay.
And related to like my dream thing with this PEP 750, the future of Python web development, I have a particular history that's interested really deeply in pre-rendering, static site generation, that kind of thing.
Okay.
And I'm really interested in JSON blobs in SQLite.
Okay. Returning them, huh?
No. Storing them.
Okay.
Indexing into the structure and efficiently retrieving and updating unstructured data.
All right. That sounds fun.
I mean, reading Simon Willison stuff constantly when I get into this.
Yeah, yeah. That's another person I got to get on the show.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, definitely.
One of the biggest thinkers in Python.
Yeah, yeah. The last thing I always want to talk about is, how can people follow the work that you do? I feel like there's a variety of ways that that can happen here.
Frankly, I would prefer them to follow the newer generation of people.
Okay.
Let's diversify our thinking. Let's create a information ecosystem in our community that is not gatekeeped by the big boys.
Sure.
Such as valuable sources such as you.
Okay.
In Real Python. We're going to find ourselves in a year or two where the gatekeepers stop sending people to us.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. Yeah.
And it sure would be great if, you know, the what's the most valuable thing in Python? Well, there's the software, there's the community, there's the foundation, but also like this media empire, you know,
yeah,
based on whatever, RSS, Mastodon, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that would be kind of a cool outcome. So let's all diversify our thing. Velda puts out a newsletter, which is really fun and cool to read.
Okay.
So let's get out of our silos. Let's benefit from these other voices. Let's also give gratitude back to them. Let's amplify each other.
Yeah, I was on the periphery during the great blogassance, if you will, that happened, and all these kind of things bloomed. But I used to really enjoy going and hopping around and the, you know, links to other stuff and so forth. And I was really very much saddened when these large companies basically said, come inside our little fiefdom and everything will be great and we'll promote you and so forth. And then, you know, it was all just a sham.
Yes,
from the beginning. And it just sucks. It's just so sad. And I am a user of Mastodon, like of all these things, the sort of federation idea, it's still working its way.
Sure.
But that is the place that I see the conversations.
Sure.
Like I see the core developers and other people talking and some of these other in whatever you want to call them, you know, the people that are luminaries in our, our industry are there. I just wish I could find some more of them. So please follow me.
So, well said.
Because I'm trying to find more of those voices. I'll definitely include my information there. I don't know if, are you a user?
I am. Unfortunately, I've reached, when I kicked the Twitter habit,
yeah,
I was suddenly like, wow, I got so much time on my hands now. But now back to the point of checking Mastodon constantly. I got this great desktop client from Tapbots. And
yeah, that's good. Yeah. Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, Paul, it's been fantastic to talk to you. I've been waiting to do this for quite a while. So thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. We of that age know that someone should start recording some of this because age is becoming an issue.
Yeah, definitely. I've heard of oral histories on lots of other things, and I think it might be interesting to have one. And I'm definitely an audio guy. Yeah, Guido's
done a number of things that are just really fascinating.
Okay. Has he done them as audio or is he mainly written?
He was on Lex Fridman. He's done writing.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's right.
I think he's been interviewed on some oral histories.
Okay.
But I think that there's more that can be done. And certainly...
Well, there's a lot of other players too, right?
That's exactly what I mean.
Yeah.
A lot of players, a lot of important people, like all of the people from PyLadies.
Well, again, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And don't forget, our sponsor, Sentry. At Sentry, we don't just build tools. We use them to debug our trickiest slowdowns. Read more challenging debugging stories at blog.sentry.io. I want to thank Paul Everett for coming on the show this week. And I want to thank you for listening to the Real Python Podcast. Make sure that you click that follow button in your podcast player. And if you see a subscribe button somewhere, remember that the Real Python Podcast is free. If you like the show, please leave us a review. You can find show notes with links to all the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.